Yep, which appeared kind of recently, and I've done all this work in collaboration with these people, John Ford, Amanda Pitt, and Ashish Saxena at the University of Toronto. So that's a plan of my talk. I will probably spend a large part of my time reviewing known facts about third-dimensional GR, but I will put together these old results and some new observations to present some methods to generate a solution carrying angular momentum starting from a static solution, and another problem, which is generating solutions carrying KK monopole charge starting from five-dimensional flat solutions. So let me start first with a brief motivation. So as I was saying, my talk is mainly about general relativity techniques to generate exact solutions in GR. Now, everyone that has played a little bit with Einstein's equations knows that it's typically it's quite a hard problem. It's also usually a useful problem, knowing exact solutions, a useful problem to solve. And one can find many, many reasons why knowing exact solution is useful. Well, my main motivation is coming from string theory. So, especially in the recent years, it has been understood that in dimensions greater than 4, the structure of general relativity is very rich and very interesting. In particular, there are many phases. The uniqueness theorem doesn't hold, so one has black holes with different topologies, so spherical black holes, black rings. One also have many phases when you compactify things on KK circles. So, and I think it's an important problem for any theory of quantum gravity to be able to explain this structure that comes from classical general relativity. So, string theory has been successful already in explaining a large part of these aspects. For example, it has given a well-known, provided a well-known microscopic derivation of black hole entropy. It has explained Hawking radiation. It has also explained some more refined features like Gregory-Laflamme type instabilities in KK compactifications. So I think that knowing new solutions or new classical solutions will just provide new examples and so new testing grounds for any theory of quantum gravity, and in particular string theory. So I will focus in this talk mainly on the case of five-dimensional solutions, and the reason why I'm choosing five-dimensional is because it's the first case above four dimensions, which is which presents some non-trivial and surprising features. In particular, it's the first case in which one can see black hole non-uniqueness, the fact that for given asymptotic charges, you can have different black hole configurations. For example, you can have a black hole whose horizon topology is S3, but you can also have a black ring whose horizon topology is S2 plus S1. So in five dimensions, one can already see a rich structure of solutions. But it's also a case which is quite easy to solve, actually much easier than other cases like the five-dimensional cases, the dimensions with larger than 5. Now, these cases were recently discussed in a paper by Amparan, Harmark, Niarkos, Roberts, and Rodriguez, and they have shown that the situation in dimensions greater than 5 is much more complicated. While in dimension 5, for some technical reasons that I will explain you later, the situation is easier, okay, and it's actually quite close. The problem is quite close to be fully solved. Okay, so I will concentrate on this case. And just for simplicity, I will always consider vacuum solutions, so solutions carrying solutions in which only the metric is excited and no other. Only the five-dimensional metric is excited and no other fields. So these solutions are just characterized by this Einstein equation.
What do you mean by being fully solved?
I will explain it better later, but I mean that you can essentially find explicit expression for all the solutions in five dimensions which are stationary and axis symmetric. That's it. That's it. So let me set up the problem and let me also review some of the results which are known until now. Now I will look at solutions which are asymptotically approaching five-dimensional Minkowski space. Now, the rotation group in five dimensions is SO4, so its rank is 2. That means that this solution asymptotically has two Killing symmetries corresponding to these two angles, phi and psi. Okay. Now, this is not, I will assume that these two Killing vectors are preserved in the full geometry, okay, not only asymptotically. This is not necessarily the most general situation to consider, because there is a theorem by Hollands, Ishibashi, and Wald that shows that a black hole solution in five dimensions needs to have one actual symmetry, not necessarily two. But on the other hand, all non-solutions have two actual symmetries, and there is not a single solution with only one actual symmetry which is known. So I will stick to the case with two actual symmetries. Okay? And this is much simpler, as you can imagine. Now, another assumption that I make is the fact that the solutions are stationary, so they have an extra Killing vector, which is corresponding to time. So altogether, I have three Killing vectors, which I denote by d over dyi. Okay? So collectively, the index I goes over 0, 1, and 2, and represents the time and the two angular directions. Now, it can be proved, and it was proved by Wald and Paran and Rial, that if you consider the two-dimensional subspaces orthogonal to all these three Killing vectors, then these subspaces are integrable. That means that you can find two-dimensional submanifolds which are orthogonal to all these Killing vectors. So you can pick coordinates, xA, on these two-dimensional subspaces. And then you can write the metric in this form. So it's just the sum of a three-dimensional part and a two-dimensional part. Every function depends only on the two coordinates, xA, on these two-dimensional subspaces. So this is the general structure of the metric. But to make some more progress, we also need to pick some particular coordinates on this two-dimensional subspace. These coordinates are usually called Weyl canonical coordinates, and they are defined like this. So consider the determinant of this three-dimensional metric, Gij. Okay, so that's the three-dimensional part of the metric. Now, this determinant in general is not a constant function. If it's constant, it's a very singular case, which I'm not considering. So it's some function of the two-dimensional coordinates, and I can pick one of my coordinates, which I'm calling r, to be just defined like this. So r square is minus the determinant of g. This fixes the first coordinate. And then I can pick a second coordinate, z, in such a way that it's orthogonal to r. Okay? So in general, it's up to a conformal factor. The metric will be a dr square plus a piece proportional to dz square times some function of r and z in general. Now I can use the equations of motion. Now, the equations of motion tell me that the Ricci tensor is vanishing. And one can show that this implies that this function lambda is independent of r. Okay. So if it's independent of r, it's only a function of z. And then by some, if it's only a function of z, then I can just, by redefining my coordinate z, essentially make it 1. Okay, that's just a redefinition of z. I want to point out that this is a very crucial simplification that happens in the case of a vacuum solution. For example, if you are looking at another interesting problem, which is looking for solution with a cosmological constant, for example, this is no more true, and the case is much more complicated. But in our case, so we are lucky, that means that the full five-dimensional metric can be written in this form. Okay, so it's a three-dimensional part, and then a two-dimensional part, which is conformally flat. Okay. And the coordinate r is defined like this. Okay. Let me also point out that I could have gotten here much faster, because if you have a two-dimensional metric, you know that at least locally this is always conformally equivalent to flat space. The only reason why I went through all this derivation is because this result is actually stronger than that. It's not only conformally equivalent to flat space, but the r coordinate is chosen in such a way that it satisfies this equation. Okay. So this will simplify many of the things that follows. Okay. So this is the first general result. Now, using these coordinates, you can look at the remaining Einstein's equations. Okay, and you find that the remaining Huysen's equation can be summarized by these two equations here. Okay? So U and V are just 3 by 3 matrices. Okay? G is a 3 by 3 matrix, I remind you. U and V are 3 by 3 matrices defined like this. So the first equation can be written in matrix form like this. Okay? So it's an equation that only involves G. Okay? The second equation is the equation that determines the conformal factor here. Okay? This nu. So obviously, you want to solve this equation in the order I've written here. Okay? So you first would like to solve this equation and find G. And then once you have G, you can substitute it in the second equation and find nu. So the second equation then poses no problem. Once G is known, you can always integrate this equation and find nu. So the whole problem reduces to solve this equation here. Okay. Now, this looks like a very simple equation, but it's in general not very easy to solve, because as you can see, if this matrix here is a general matrix, this equation is a partial differential equation, coupled partial differential equations, all the components mixed together. So it's in general not an obviously easy problem to solve. There are some cases in which this problem simplifies. And the simplest case is the case in which the GIG matrix is diagonal. Okay? This case corresponds to static solutions, so it's solutions that do not carry any angular momentum or anything like that. They don't have any mixing between the Killing directions. Then this GIG matrix is diagonal. If the GIG matrix is diagonal, it's easy to see that the equation I've written before just reduces to this simple equation. Okay, so what happens is that every equation, the equations decouple. So I have three independent equations for the three functions, G0, G1, and G2. And moreover, the equations are also very simple. They just, they're just saying that the logarithm of GI, it's a harmonic function, okay, because this box here is nothing but the Laplace operator on this, with respect to this metric, which is the three-dimensional flat metric written in cylindrical coordinates. Okay? This coordinate phi here, it's a fictitious coordinate that I'm just introducing for convenience so that I can write this equation in this way. So it's a fictitious coordinate on which nothing depends. Okay? So all the functions I'm looking at will be phi independent. Okay? Now, So this is easy. This is an easy problem. So I just have to look for harmonic functions on three-dimensional space. Okay. Now, with axial symmetry with respect to the r equal to 0 axis, okay, which is the z-axis in my case. Now, all these functions can be written as a linear combination of these two basic functions here. One is the logarithm of r squared, and the other one is the logarithm of mu I, where mu I is this function of r and z, and pi are just any point along the z-axis. Okay? So I can write many functions like this, depending on how many points I have on the z-axis. Okay? So if you look at these functions have sources on the z-axis, obviously, since this is a harmonic function, if you want to have something non-trivial, they have to have sources somewhere. So the sources are the places where the argument of the logarithm vanishes. So in the case of log r squared, obviously, it vanishes everywhere on the r equal to 0 axis. So the source is just spread all over the z-axis. In the case of log of mu I, this function vanishes for r equal to 0 and z greater than pi. Okay, so the source for this function here is just a semi-infinite line starting at the point pi. Okay? And now any other solution you can think of can be written as a linear combination of these two ones. And the condition that the determinant of G is minus R squared, if you rewrite it in this language, just means that if you sum up all the sources corresponding to the function G0, G1, and G2, all these sources has to sum up to 1, okay, because that's the source corresponding to R squared. Okay. So these are just the rules by which you can construct static solutions. Pick harmonic functions and choose the sources in such a way that they satisfy this sum rule, if you want, and you'll find a solution. Now, the simplest case, let me present some examples. Okay? The simplest example you can think of is the five-dimensional Minkowski space itself. If you write five-dimensional Minkowski space in these coordinates, you find that the metric reads like this. Okay? And if you look at the sources of this functions here, you find that, well, obviously there is no source along time because the metric is trivial along time. There are sources along phi and psi. So this function here corresponds to phi, and this function here corresponds to psi. Okay. What I'm denoting G1 is just the G phi phi component of the metric, and G2 is the G psi psi component of the metric. Okay. Now, the G11, the G phi phi component of the metric vanishes on this axis, on this part of the Z axis. This is just the place where the phi phi coordinates degenerate. So it's just the rotation axis for phi. Okay. Actually, in five dimensions, it's not really an axis, it's a plane. So it's a rotation plane for phi. Okay. Analogously, there is a place where G psi psi vanishes, and that's the rotation axis for psi. Okay. So this will be a feature which is present in all solutions which are asymptotically Minkowski. So all solutions which are asymptotically Minkowski will have two, okay, by the way, let me introduce a terminology. These sources are called rods in the literature. Okay. So this asymptotically flat solution will always have two semi-infinite rods, one at the left and the other one at the right, that corresponds just to the rotation axis of phi and psi. Okay. Now, all the other solutions, now I can construct more complicated solutions. Okay, all I can do is I have to keep these two semi-infinite rods there, okay, so if I want the solution to be asymptotically flat. All I can do is I can add finite rods somewhere, either along T, phi, or psi. Okay. So the simplest...
Along the four axis? You mean why they are along phi and psi? Well, because the phi coordinates vanishes. Well, if you are in, for example, in polar coordinates, the phi coordinate vanishes, let's say, at t equal to 0. The psi coordinate degenerates at t equal to pi by 2. So it's two different places. Okay. So they correspond to these two different rods. Now, okay, so the next thing that I said corresponds to taking some finite rod somewhere. Okay. So you can put the finite rod a long time now. And this corresponds to the five-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. Okay. Why this is a black hole? Well, because I have a finite rod a long time. That means that GTT vanishes here. Okay. So the place of GTT vanishes in this case is nothing but the horizon. Okay. So this finite rod a long time corresponds to the horizon. Now, it's also easy to see from this picture that this horizon is topology S3. So this is really a Schwarzschild black hole. And you see this by looking at this interval. Okay, so you have this interval, and over this interval you have two coordinates, psi and phi, which are phi coordinates. Now, at one end of the interval, the psi coordinate vanishes. At the other end of the integral of the interval, the phi coordinate vanishes. So that's exactly what an S3 is. Okay, it's an interval with two compact fibers on it, and the two fibers vanish at their opposite ends. So this is a representation of the 5D black hole. Now, the next case you can consider, well, you can put another finite rod somewhere. Now, a finite rod, you cannot put it a long time because there is a finite rod here already. So you can put it either along phi or psi, okay? But phi and psi essentially appear symmetrically. So up to a permutation of phi and psi, the only other case you can consider with two finite rods is this one. Okay? So in this case, I still have one finite rod a long time, which again corresponds to the horizon. In this case, however, the topology of the horizon has changed, and it's also easy to see what the topology is. So again, I have an interval with phi and psi fiber over it, but now at the two ends of the interval, it's the same coordinate that shrinks. Okay. So that means it's an S2. Okay. And then I have an extra coordinate, which is this phi here, which never shrinks over the horizon. Okay, so that just gives me an S1 factor. So that means that the topology of this horizon here is S2 plus S1. So this solution represents a black hole. Now, it's also easy to see from this kind of pictorial representation why you can have only one topology in four dimensions and two different topologies in five dimensions. Because in five dimensions, you have this in order to have this configuration, it's essential that you have these two directions of radio frequency. If you only have one, then the only thing you can do is a topology S2 or S3. So this tutorial representation is usually pretty intuitive and convenient to study these solutions. But all I've said to you until now only refers to the very simple case of static solutions. Now, let me see what you can still keep of this structure once you go over to the more general case of stationary solutions. So solutions which are not static anymore, so for which your G matrix is not diagonal. Now, it has been shown quite recently by Palmer that this concept of rod structure that I have introduced before can still be generalized to the general stationary case. And the generalization goes as follows. By definition, the determinant of G is minus R squared. So at R equal to zero, the determinant of G vanishes. That means that the matrix G has some contiguous kernel. Now, this kernel could have any dimension in principle, but you can show by looking at by computing the mu tensor of the matrix, if you want. You can show that if the kernel of G is two-dimensional, for some generic values of Z, okay? So if it's two-dimensional for a finite interval along Z, then the metric is singular. So you cannot allow two-dimensional kernels over an extended Z interval. That means that generically the kernel of G has to be dimension 1. Now,
you are allowed to have the dimension of the kernel of G to be equal to 2 only at isolated points on the Z-axis. So there are some isolated points, which I'm calling PI, where the kernel becomes jumps by one unit, so it becomes two-dimensional. So I can divide my z-axis into intervals, okay? And the intersection between the intervals are these points, PI, okay? If I look inside every one of these intervals, the kernel is one-dimensional, so there is a unique vector here that satisfies G of V is equal to 0, so which is in the kernel of G. Now, in principle, this vector here could still depend on Z because G is a function of R and Z, and at R equal to 0, it's a function of Z. Okay. So you could think that V is a function of Z, but it has been shown in this paper by Hallmark, using essentially the equations of motions, that actually inside this interval, the vector V is a constant. Okay. So it's just a constant linear combination of your three Killing vectors. So, but when you jump from one interval to the other, this vector can change, however. Okay? At the places where this vector changes are exactly the places where the dimension of the kernel is dimension 2, because there I have two vectors. Okay? So the picture is very simple. So I have my z-axis. I divide it into intervals. Okay? And for each one of these intervals, I have a constant vector vi, okay, which I can associate to it. So this set of data is what I'm calling the rod structure. Okay? And it just generalizes the pictures that I was showing you before. Okay? In the case that I was showing before, it's the case in which this VI lie only along one of these directions. So only one of these, either along the T or along phi or along psi. Okay? So if this is what you can have, is the metric is static. But if it's not static, in general, the V, it's a combination of all three Killing vectors. So the simplest case you can consider is the case of the Myers-Perry black hole. So if you take a black hole and you give it some angular momentum, some spin, you find the Myers-Perry black hole. And the rod structure for the Myers-Perry black hole is identical to the rod structure of the static black hole. The only difference is that now the vector associated to the horizon here is not simply along dt, but it's also partly along d phi and d psi. And the two constants here are nothing but the angular velocities of the horizon. Okay? So you can read off from this rod structure the physical quantities that characterize the solution. In this case, these are essentially the two angular momenta of the solution. Okay? So this is very simple, and it's also very useful because it provides an important classification of all stationary solutions with two axial symmetries. It has been shown, indeed, in a very recent paper by Hollands and Yazandjev, that this rod structure also uniquely characterizes your solution. So More precisely, if you have two stationary solutions, which are asymptotically are 4,1, and they are vacuum solutions of Einstein gravity with two axial symmetries, and they are stationary, then these two solutions are identical if and only if their rod structure is the same, coincide. Okay, so if you give the rod structure, you uniquely specify your solution. So now the problem you're left to solve is the problem of explicitly finding this solution. Okay, given some rod structure, there must be some solution corresponding to it, and you want to find explicitly what this solution is. Okay. To do this, you have to solve the equation of motion that I was showing to you before, which are these equations of motion. Okay, and then you have to solve this problem, which I was saying before, it's in principle not very easy. Now, I don't have time to go into any details on this, but it has been shown, okay, already many years ago by Belinsky and Sakharov, and which did it for four dimensions, and recently this has been also extended to all other dimensions by Pomeransky. It has been shown that the problem of solving this equation is actually integral. Okay. What I mean by integral, well, concretely it means that there are some transformations which are called inverse scattering transformations that in principle allows you to generate all solutions of this equation starting from some known solution. Okay. So at least in principle you could say that the problem is solved already. Okay. However, this is only in principle, not in practice, because if you really want to find some particular solution using this inverse scattering transformation, you don't really know how to do, okay? So it's just, you have to do some trial and error kind of procedure, okay? And most of the times, if you just try to generate a solution using some inverse scattering transformation, you'll end up with solutions which are horribly singular. For example, you typically end up with singularities at the intersection between the rods and so on. Okay? So this is an in principle important result, but in practice not very useful, not all the times very useful. So what we propose, we propose a different method to solve the same problem here, so to generate solution of these equations. Okay. Now, this method that we proposed is based on some SL3 symmetry of five-dimensional general relativity. So I have to spend some more time reviewing where this SL3 symmetry comes from. Okay. Now, the SL3 symmetry, in this case, holds in an even more general setting than the one I've shown you before. So, in particular, you need to consider stationary solutions with only one extra Killing vector, which I'm calling d over d xi 1. Okay. So, altogether, you have two Killing vectors. One is time, because the solution is stationary, and the other one is some other Killing vector, okay, which I'm denoting as xi 1. Okay. Now, given these two Killing vectors, you can decompose the metric with respect to these Killing vectors like this. Okay, so this is okay, the usual. If you want, you can think of this as like dimensionally reducing the metric along these two Killing directions. Okay. So your whole metric is parametrized in terms of some three-dimensional metric, okay, which is parametrizing all coordinates which are neither time nor psi 1. And then you have a 2x2 matrix, lambda AB. Okay, it's a matrix of scalars, 2x2. And then you have two gauge fields. Okay, so these omega A are just one forms of these on this three-dimensional space here. Okay. Now, the essential simplifications comes here because in three dimensions, if you have a gauge field, in three dimensions, a gauge field is dual to a scalar. Okay? So if you have gauge fields, omega A, you can actually trade them for scalars, which I'm calling VA, okay? Which are the Hodge duals of, so the VA are just the Hodge duals of the omega A, according to this equation here. Okay? So all your metric is parametrized in terms of some three-dimensional metric here, okay? Plus a bunch of scalars, which are this lambda AB and this VA. And all these scalars, you can conveniently organize them into a 3x3 matrix, which I'm calling chi. Okay. This, by construction, is a symmetric matrix, and it's also unimodular. Its determinant is 1, okay, by construction. So this is a convenient way to organize the scalars of your solution, because now if you write the equations of motion for these solutions, in terms of this matrix chi, then the equations of motion take this form here. Okay. So you have a first equation of motion that involves chi, and a second equation of motion that involves chi and the Ricci tensor computed with the three-dimensional metric, ds squared 3. Okay. Now, written in this form, it's easy to see that the equations of motion have a symmetry, okay, which is the following. So you can take the chi matrix and multiply it by n and n transpose, where n is any SL3 transformation. Okay? And also you don't change the three-dimensional part of the matrix. If you do this, these equations of motions are obviously invariant. And also chi remains symmetric and unimodular. Okay, the fact that you want to preserve the fact that chi is unimodular is what restricts this transformation to SL3. So this is an obvious, in this form, it's an obvious symmetry of the equations of motion. So you can use it to generate new solutions, starting from old solutions. Now, however, before you can understand what is the physical meaning of these new solutions that you're generating, you have to ask what is the asymptotic structure of the solution that you're generating. And in general, this, if you act with a generic transformation n here, then you can see that n doesn't preserve the asymptotic structure in general. So it can map solutions which are asymptotically flat to solutions which are not asymptotically flat. So you have to be careful about this, okay? So you have to find the subgroup of SL3 which preserves the asymptotic structure. Now, let me consider first the case in which the asymptotic structure is the following. So it's four-dimensional Minkowski space times a circle S1. So this is what I will always denote from now on as four-dimensional boundary conditions. So I'm calling them four-dimensional because there is a four-dimensional Minkowski factor, and then I have just a Kaluza-Klein circle S1. This case has been considered extensively in the literature. Actually, it's the only case in which this SL3 invariance has been applied to. Okay? And for example, it has been used by these people, Rashid and Larsen, to construct some solutions. Okay? Now, if asymptotically your space has this structure, then it means that it has this form here, okay, where X5 is just a coordinate parametrizing the S1. Now, you can pick as your killing vector, Xi1, you can pick X5 directly, okay, the coordinate on this S1. If you do this and decompose the matrix in the way that I've shown you before, it's easy to see that the chi matrix asymptotically goes over to this diagonal and constant matrix here, which I'm denoting as eta4. Okay, so the -1 just corresponds to the minus dt squared, the +1 is just the dx5 squared, and this -1 here is just the -1/tau entry in the definition of chi, if you remember the definition of chi. So if you want to preserve this asymptotic structure, then you have to look for matrices N which preserve eta4. Okay, so matrices N that satisfy this equation. And this by definition just defines the group SO2,1. Okay. So that means that you have three transformations that preserve the asymptotic structure. These are the three generators of SO2,1. You can pick them like this, okay, N alpha and beta and N gamma. And the physical meaning of these three transformations, it's clear also. So N alpha, for example, is nothing but a boost along X5. So this is a transformation that only mixes time with X5. So it's just a boost along X5. So if you act on a solution with N alpha, you produce a new solution which in general carries a momentum charge along your circle S1. If you act with N beta, which is this other transformation here, you can also see, okay, it's probably a little bit less intuitive, but it's easier to see that this transformation here adds KK monopole charge towards your solution. Okay? And if you act with this transformation here, which is similar to beta, it's just that it interchanges the role of X5 with time. So this transformation here generates what is called an up charge. An up charge is just a term in the metric which mixes time with your angular coordinate phi. Okay? So usually you don't want an up charge because if you have an up charge, the solution is not asymptotically flat. Okay? But anyway, you have solutions that also introduce this nap charge. And this can be used because if you act with these two transformations together, sometimes you generate a nap charge. So you need to use this transformation here also to compensate and kill the nap charge. However, this is well known. It has been used in the literature many times. What is less known is the application of this SL3 symmetry to generate solutions which asymptotically are five-dimensional Minkowski space. Okay? So there is no compact S1 here. It's just a five-dimensional Minkowski space. So we have worked out this application in this paper with Ashish Saxena. Now, so consider a solution which is asymptotically R4,1. The solution asymptotically has this form. Now you have one killing vector, which is time, as usual. But then you have two other killing vectors, phi and psi. And you have to decide which one of these killing vectors you want to identify with your psi1, which is the killing vector with respect to which you want to decompose the metric. Okay. Now, in principle, you have a lot of choices possible. You can take any combination of phi and psi. However, it turns out that if you want to find some non-trivial structure, if you want to find a non-trivial subgroup of SL3 that preserves this structure, there are only these two choices which are possible. Okay? So these are just the Euler angles, if you want, the Euler angles of S3. Okay? So you can either take the combination psi plus phi or the combination psi minus phi. Let me take the first combination just for definiteness. Okay? If you take the first combination and you decompose this metric with respect to the killing vector psi1, and you construct the matrix chi, you find that the matrix chi at infinity goes over to this constant matrix again. Okay? So it's similar to the matrix eta4 that I found before. It's just that it's not diagonal. It has two ones here. What is important is that it's a constant matrix, nevertheless. This didn't have to be, okay? It could have been any function of theta, for example, theta or r, okay? So it's only if you choose this particular combination that this is a constant matrix, okay? So an asymptotically five-dimensionally flat metric has a chi which goes over to eta 5. Now, the other important observation is that eta 5 is related to the eta 4 I have found before by some SL3 transformation, which explicitly I have written it down here. Okay. So the case going from the five-dimensional to the four-dimensional case just amounts to replacing eta 4 with eta 5. And eta 4, moreover, it's also related to eta 5 in this way. Okay. So if you want to see what are the transformations which preserve this structure, so the transformation M which preserve the matrix eta 5. Using the previous observation, it's easy to see that these transformations M are nothing but, again, isomorphic to SO2,1, but you have to conjugate with this matrix D, okay, which is switching between eta 4 and eta 5. Okay, so this is a very simple observation, but this identifies the subgroup of transformations that preserve five-dimensional boundary conditions. Okay? Now, until here, I've shown you that this is a necessary condition for having asymptotically flat solutions. So the condition that chi asymptotically approaches eta 5 is certainly necessary for having asymptotic boundary conditions. I haven't shown you that it's also sufficient. In principle, you can see easily that a priori you could have generated terms of this form. Okay? Even this is consistent with having a chi matrix, which is simply eta 5. So you have to check, you have to be more careful, and you have to check that actually terms of these forms are not allowed. Okay? Now, this I cannot explain you here, but a more careful analysis shows that these terms are not generated. Okay? So that means that we are done. So that means that we know exactly what is the group of transformations that sends five-dimensional asymptotically flat solutions into five-dimensional asymptotically flat solutions. Okay? And this is a transformation that you can use to, as a solution-generated technique. Okay? So let me show you what is the... okay, let me skip a technical remark. And let me show you what is the... first of all, the physical meaning of the solutions that you generate by acting with these kind of transformations. And then I'll give you an example. Okay? Now, as I said before, the matrix M that preserves the boundary condition is isomorphic to SO2,1, so it has, in principle, three parameters. However, two of these three parameters, they really do nothing physical. Okay? They just correspond to some change of coordinates. In particular, if you take this transformation here, which depends on one parameter, beta, this transformation just rescales your coordinate psi1 and rescales your coordinate on the three-dimensional space by an inverse vector. Okay, so this certainly just will not give you any new solution. Also, there is another transformation which also depends on one parameter S here, which is more complicated, which just is just a shift of the time coordinate. Okay, so even this transformation doesn't produce any new solution. So you're left out of three parameters, you have to take away two, so you're left with only one parameter in this case. Okay. And what this parameter corresponds to? Well, loosely speaking, it corresponds to add angular momentum to the solution. Okay. Now, I can give you an example for this. I can start with the five-dimensional black hole, whose rod structure is this one. And I can act on this solution with a matrix M like this. What you find is, by simple computation, you find that the rod structure of the solution is this one. So what has happened is that this transformation M has rotated this rod here, and it has made it into, it has transformed the corresponding eigenvector into this eigenvector here. Okay. Now notice that the two angular velocity here are equal. Okay. This corresponds to the fact that you are only acting on a coordinate psi 1, which is psi plus phi. Okay? So essentially, you are adding angular momentum only diagonally, only to this, on equal amounts both on psi and phi. So what is this solution? This solution is the Myers-Perry solution with two equal angular momenta, okay? Omega 1 and omega 5. Now, you can ask if you can do something better, if you can generate the full Myers-Perry solution. Okay? And the answer is yes. In order to find the way to do it, you have to realize that you have another Kinning vector in the game. Okay? You have used psi plus phi, but you could have equally used psi minus phi. Okay? So now, if you apply on psi minus phi, you can repeat exactly the same kind of construction that I've shown you before. You can decompose the metric with respect to this psi tilde 1, which is psi minus phi, and you can act with a SL3 transformation after you have decomposed the metric in this way. Okay? You will find something. Okay? So the procedure of changing, of decomposing the metric with respect to psi 1 or with respect to psi tilde 1, this procedure we call it flip. Okay? So this is just a formal procedure. In principle, you're describing the same metric. Okay? You're just describing the same metric in different, in a different form, if you want. The way this is, the reason this is useful is because once you have done this flip, you can act now on this data here with another SL3 transformation. This doesn't commute. Acting with SL3 doesn't commute with doing the flip. If it did commute, you would do nothing useful because you would again, you would just reproduce this transformation again. But this doesn't commute, so that means that you can generate some new solution. Okay, so if you apply it again to the case of the Myers-Perry solution, you start from the Myers-Perry solution with two equal angular momenta that we have arrived at before. You do a flip. You apply an extra SL3 transformation. Now, this transformation acts on this psi minus phi coordinate, so it adds angular momentum now. Now it adds the other angular momentum, so you find the full Myers-Perry solution at the end. Okay. So this is a very simple way to generate, Myers-Perry solution, for example, which was not originally a very simple solution to find. But so that shows that in principle, this kind of generating technique can be useful. Okay. All you have to do, you just have to do matrix multiplications, okay, to generate solutions carrying angular momentum starting from static solutions. Now, what we can say in general? Well, in general, we can say that if you start from a static solution, and this solution has n finite rods, okay, that's the most general case you can consider, and you apply a transformation M to it, you will find that you will generate another solution whose number of rods and whose rod positions are the same. Okay? So what I have found in the case of the Myers-Perry was that the position of the rods never changed. Okay? What changes instead is the fact that the eigenvectors associated to every rod are rotated by these SL3 transformations. Okay? So you these SL3 transformations acting in static solutions, they just rotate the eigenvectors associated to each rod. Now you can iterate this procedure also. You can act with a flip and then another n transformation, and in principle do this as many times as you want. Now, sooner or later, you'll have to stop, meaning that you won't find any new transformations if you go on like this. The reason is that there are only a finite number of parameters that you can add to the solution. Now, let's count how many parameters you have. If you have n finite rods, for every rod, you have two parameters. That, so for every rod, you have to specify the eigenvector. Now, the eigenvector is a three-dimensional vector, but it's defined up to normalization. So obviously, it contains only two parameters. So for every rod, you have two parameters. All together, you can have 2n parameters in a solution with n finite rods. So what we conjecture that if you perform these transformations in 2n steps, you will generate the most general stationary and axisymmetric solutions with n finite rods. Okay? This is, until now, just a conjecture. We cannot really prove it, but I think it's plausible that this is true from all what I've told you before. Okay? Now, I also have to tell you that this construction, in principle, generates all solutions. In practice, it might not be very easy to apply in complicated cases. And the difficulty comes because at every step, you actually have to solve some duality equations, because you have to go from the metric to this matrix sky. And to do this, you have to solve some duality equations. In complicated cases, this can be, sometimes it can be hard. Okay, so I'm not saying that in all practical cases, this can be done, okay, at least easily. I have some technical comments on how this can be simplified. This problem can be simplified, okay, but this is technical, so I don't think that I will tell you anything about this. Okay. Now, let me just present the last application of this formalism, okay, which was developed in a paper with Ford, Peter, and Saxena. Okay. This application just uses essentially the same observation, the same SL3 symmetry as I've used before. And it uses it to add KK monopole charge to some solution. Okay. So the problem is the following. Suppose that you start with a five-dimensional solution, which is asymptotically R4,1. You can try to solve the following problem, to find a new solution which represents this five-dimensional geometry, but sitting at the center of some KK monopole geometry. Okay. This new solution will have a different asymptotic structure now, if you have put the solution inside the KK monopole geometry. The KK monopole has a compact circle. So asymptotically, the solution will look like Minkowski space times S1. Okay. So I have changed the asymptotics from this to this. Okay. Moreover, I have introduced one more parameter in the solution, which you can think of as the radius of the KK monopole, okay, with this RK here. And the solution that you construct will have the property that if you take RK to infinity, you find the original solution back again. Okay? It corresponds to the decompactification limit. While if you take RK to zero, this corresponds, you will find a four-dimensional solution. Now, the fact that there are this solution, that the fact that this kind of solution exists has played some important role in recent developments, also in string theory. For example, Gaiotto, Strominger, and Yin have used the fact that you can construct geometries that interpolate between 4D and 5D to show that the partition functions dual to these geometries are equal. Okay, so this is the basis of what is now called the 4D-5D connection. Obviously, this only works in cases in which you can assume that the partition functions are independent of RK. Okay? But in these cases usually are supersymmetric cases, but not necessarily, so you only need to have that the solution is extremal for this property of RK independence to hold. Okay? So you don't necessarily need to have supersymmetry for this to be true. So it can be useful to apply this construction also to non-supersymmetric cases. But in general, it's difficult, because while in the supersymmetric case, there is a systematic way to generate this geometry here. And the reason is because a supersymmetric solution essentially can be encoded in terms of some harmonic functions. And if you want to add KK monopole charge, this only amounts to add some constant to these harmonic functions. So this is, in general, a quite easy problem if you have supersymmetry. But if you don't have supersymmetry, all this nice structure breaks down. So in principle, it's not known how to solve this problem for non-supersymmetric solutions. So what we point out is that the SL3 transformation that we have found before actually solves this problem in the case of vacuum solutions with two axial symmetries. Okay. So, and to do this, I just have to remind you what I've said before. So I just have to remind you that the five-dimensional solution has a chi matrix that goes over to eta 5. A four-dimensional solution has a chi matrix that goes over to eta 4. And eta 5 and eta 4 are related by an SL3 transformation D, which I shown you before. This means that if you take the five-dimensional solution, 5D, and you apply on it this matrix D, you will convert its boundary conditions to be the four-dimensional kind. Okay? So, and you will generate another solution, because by construction, this is a solution, the equations of motion. So this procedure just produces the metric you're looking for. So it just produces a metric which interpolates between four dimensions and five-dimensional solutions. Okay? So this can be used in full generality to generate this kind of matrix. Now, the simplest example I can give of this procedure is, for example, the generation of the gross Perry monopole. This is very simple. You can start with five-dimensional Minkowski space, which I write here in a slightly unusual form. This is like a Gibbons-Hawking form, okay, in which the solution, this is nothing but five-dimensional Minkowski space, just written in a slightly strange form, where V is this potential here, 1 over R. Now, the chi matrix corresponding to this geometry, well, you can work it out easily, is this one. And if you act with D on this chi matrix, all you do, essentially, is to replace V with 1 plus V, actually 1 plus V over 2. Okay. So if you reconstruct the four-dimensional metric out of this chi, you find that, as I said, all you have done is just add a constant to the potential V that you had before. So this is nothing but the Myers-Perry monopole. Okay? The fact that this V here goes to a constant, goes like a constant rather than 1 over R, means that now this circle psi 1 here, which was a non-compact circle in the four-dimensional geometry, has become compact, meaning that at infinity, its size just goes to a constant 1. Okay? So this is a simple example of this application. Now, let me also point out that if you compute the rod structure for this solution, the four-dimensional one, and this solution here, the five-dimensional one, you'll find that the rod structure are identical. Okay? So the rod structure cannot distinguish cannot detect the KK monopole charge, if you want. So it cannot distinguish between 5D and four-dimensional solutions. This is not in contradiction with the uniqueness theorem that I was showing before, because the uniqueness theorem implicitly assumes that you have five-dimensional asymptotics. Okay, so it doesn't consider this case. So the fact that you find different solutions with the same rod structure is not a contradiction with anything, but you know, you just have to keep it in mind, because if you use the rod structure, you can really understand everything from the rod structure. The asymptotics is not captured. Now, let me also skip this other example, which is, well, it's not so useful. Let me go over to the last example I want to tell you about, which is what you can do, what new solution you can generate with this technique. Okay? For example, one new solution which you could try to generate and which is not known is a black ring in tau naught. Okay? So you know that in five dimensions you have a black ring. You can try to put this black ring at the center of a tau naught geometry or a KK monopole geometry. And this would be a new solution which is not known yet. So as I told you, you can try to do it following the procedure I have described before. So you just start from the, let me start from the static black ring first, just for simplicity. So this is the static black ring. You apply a detransformation to it. However, there is a complication if you do this. What you expect to find the black ring in tau naught, but you don't find it. Okay? And the reason is the following. As I told you before, this SL3 transformation in general rotate the rods. Okay? They rotate every finite rods that you have in the solution. Now, D doesn't act on time, so it does nothing on this rod, but it acts, it mixes phi and psi. So if you really do this and you have a finite space-like rod in your geometry, then this space-like rod will be rotated. Now, so you end up with a four-dimensional solution with a rotated rod. That means that it's a problem, because this solution here is not even a black ring. In order to be a black ring, you want this rod to be exactly parallel to this one so that the topology of this horizon is S2 process 1. If these are not parallel, the topology is not S2 process 1. So you haven't produced the solution you wanted, really. However, there is this is a problem, but there is kind of an easy fix to this problem. All you have to do, well, you have to start from a different fine-dimensional solution. Instead of starting from the static black ring here, you have to start from a fine-dimensional solution which has this same rod structure here, in which the rod is already rotated. Okay? Now, you can fix this parameter A here, the rotation of the rod, in such a way that after you apply D to this solution, you counterbalance the rotation that the D would introduce. Okay? So by starting from a solution like this and choosing A appropriately, well, you can tune things in such a way that the final solution has a rod which is straight. Okay? So this is a black ring in Tavnat that you want to produce. Now, so you have to have a way, however, to produce this solution to start with. Okay? Now, yeah. The first solution, it's simply not the solution that you're looking for. Okay? In general, it's not even a regular solution. Because if you look at the topology of the horizon here, if this A is any real number, then the topology of the horizon is not even regular. If A is an integer, for example, then you can see that the horizon is a length space. Okay? So if A is an integer in general, you find a solution with a horizon which is like a length space. Okay? I don't know what to make of that solution. I mean, it's just a solution, but it's not the solution that you're looking at. Okay? So if you really want to look for a black ring, you have to do what I told you. You have to start from this other solution here. Okay? But then you have to generate this solution. In principle, you can do it with the SL3 transformations that I was showing to you before. I claim that with SL3, you can generate any solution with any rod configuration you want. So in principle, you can do it. Now, in practice, in this case, we found it more convenient to using the scattering technique for this particular case. You know, it turned out to be computationally just simpler. Okay? Now, there are some computational obstacles that you have to solve, but you know, some technicalities that anyway we can show that they can be solved in general. So at the end, you find the solution you want. You find the static black ring in Tavnat. Okay. Now, this static black ring is a nice solution. It just has some conical defect singularities, which are common to every static black ring. Okay. Even if you have a static black ring in flat space, you would find that the solution has some conical defects. And the reason is because a black ring is unstable against gravitational collapse. So if you don't have some angular momentum to balance the black ring, you need to have something else to balance it. Okay? In this case, you need to have conical defects. Okay? Now, if you want to find a really regular solution with no conical defects, well, you can apply the same solution starting from a rotating solution already. Okay, so you can introduce rotation in the story. This can be done along the same lines I told you, and it's something that we are currently doing with these people here. Okay. So then let me also skip this last application and just go straight to the summary. So I just remind you what I've told you today. So I told you that we have presented a method to generate stationary axisymmetric solutions of 5D gravity. The method is based on some SL3 invariants of the five-dimensional general relativity, which was already known before. We have a conjecture that this method can be used to generate all five-dimensional asymptotically flat solutions with two axial symmetries and stationary. And we have identified a subgroup of these transformations, one particular element of this transformation, which is the matrix D, which connects five-dimensional and four-dimensional geometries, and we have applied it to generate some new solution, which is a black ring in Tavnat. For multi-center solutions.
Well, for example, if you want black hole, okay, two black holes, it would be just two. How can I draw it? It would be this. In four dimensions, that's what it would be. So that's a four-dimensional multi-center black hole. So you just have repeated for ICs.
But how do I see that they're separated in the radial direction? I mean, I thought that direction was time.
This direction? No. This is Z. This is Z direction. Okay, so it's, yeah, it's drawing is done at r equal to 0, but r is not your usual radial direction. Okay, so on the space r equal to 0, you can think of Z as the radial direction.
Can you extend this to the gauge supergravity case with a cosmological constant?
Not easily. If you have a cosmological constant, as I told you before, there is the first step, the fact that you can pick the two-dimensional metric to be just dl squared plus dt squared, is not easily generalizable. You can try to do something, maybe, but it's not easy.
Can you go one page back?
Yes. Okay, so this is another application of this same idea. So the problem we wanted to solve here is we wanted to construct some microstate geometries. Okay, so meaning geometries which are completely free of singularities and of horizons, and that are dual to some CFT space. Okay. Now, it was known, it has been known for a few years, that there are some non-BPS geometries of this kind that you can construct. These were constructed by these people here, and they are geometries which are asymptotically five-dimensional. Okay, so this corresponds to, these are geometries which are dual to some non-BPS states of the five-dimensional black hole CFT. Okay, so when I'm talking about the black hole, I always mean the black hole will be one defined and peak charges in five dimensions.
That's for arbitrary p, or for small p?
Well, not for arbitrary p. You have some amount of p that you can put in order to have a regular geometry. The p is not small, okay? So the, and it's not arbitrary. It's just parametrized by some integer.
I can get quickly curved horizons, quickly curved geometries.
Yes, the geometries are quickly curved everywhere. Yes, that's certainly. So that is meaning that this p here is just it's microscopic. It's not like the demultiplied case in which you have a singularity. So, and these solutions are non-BPS, meaning that from the CFT point of view, these solutions are dual to some states in which you have both left and right moving excitations, etc. Now, what we wanted to construct some geometry which corresponds to states of the four-dimensional black hole. So we wanted to add KK charge to this black hole and find microstates of the black hole with four charges, the one defined P and KK. So this means that you have to apply some kind of construction of the type I've described before. I mean, you want to go from a five-dimensional solution to a four-dimensional solution. Now, I cannot do it directly by applying the procedure described before, because that procedure only applies to vacuum solution as it stands right now. Okay? And these are not vacuum solutions that have all these peaks, exactly all these charges. But what we could do was the following. Now, these solutions here were generated by applying some chain of dualities to some seed solution, which is a solution of vacuum concentration. So you have some seed in the particular case of the five-dimensional geometry, the seed solution was just the five-dimensional megaspace solution. Now, what we did was take this seed solution, apply the d-transformation to it, then you find the solution whose asymptotic is 4D rather than 5D, and then we apply the same chain of dualities that we have people had applied here to obtain the solution, and so we have found this four-dimensional solution that we were looking at. So these are non-BPS solutions dual to microstates of the four-dimensional black hole with P1, D5, P and P charges.
Can you say anything in general about the existence of conical singularities once you perform your transformations? And particularly if you start with the radial binary, for example, I expect you to
adjust the balance calculations. Yes. So let's look at this case. So as I was telling you, okay, since this SL3 transformation in general rotates the rods here, not possible ways. Okay. Now it is possible that the solutions have some kind of singularity. Okay, in particular, you can. I didn't really call them conical singularities. They are more like Dirac-Meissner types.
This looks a good bit worse than
Yes. So, and so I cannot, you know, I cannot exclude that in general. Okay, so for generic values, I cannot exclude it. I can always tune this transformation in such a way that, for example, if I, in this case, if I tune this transformation to make this A integer, then I avoid that kind of singularity. Okay. Or in other cases, I can act with a more general sequence of transformation in such a way that at the end, the raw structure has a in which I kill all these mixings that generate these singularities. But in general, I cannot exclude that there are singularities.
More questions? And then let's thank the speaker again.